I can't begin to tell you how lovely it is to be here actually looking at your faces. It's really great. You just don't know how much you love something until it gets taken away from you. It's good to be here. 3 years ago, for my first sermon of the year, I chose to talk about George Washington Carver, a man who not only was a brilliant scientist, but more importantly, a devout Christian who devoted his life to helping others and making the world a better place through his science and generous, loving spirit. I really liked learning about this amazing man and sharing his story with you. Several of you told me that you'd appreciated and benefited from this sermon also. As I've explained before, traditions spring up easily within the Trammell family, since anything done once and enjoyed automatically assumes tradition status. Therefore, with my Carver sermon, a tradition was born. For my first sermon of the next year, I talked about Harriet Beecher Stowe, a remarkable woman who, because of her faith, was moved to write Uncle Tom's Cabin and other works that vividly portrayed the horrors of slavery. These stories actually succeeded in raising the consciousness level of a nation, contributing to the Civil War and the emancipation of the slaves. If enjoying something once establishes a tradition, enjoying something twice sets it in stone. So, the third year found me discussing another great Christian who changed the world, Alexander Campbell, the most influential of the founding fathers of the Restoration Movement, the Christian church movement of which we at Hayes Christian are a part. Now, even though we're almost halfway through 2021, this has turned out to be my first sermon of the year. So, what else can I do but bow to tradition? Consequently, I've chosen to talk about another world-changing Christian, or in this case, two world-changing Christians, the husband-wife team, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. Jimmy Carter, as several of us know firsthand, was the 39th President of the United States, serving between 1976 and 1980. His wife, Rosalind, who has been by his side for almost 75 years, is a force in her own right. She has been a part of all their decisions, including being the first First Lady to sit in on cabinet meetings. She is Jimmy's number one advisor, and he hers. She has traveled the world quietly and with no fanfare, doing what needs to be done, including swinging a mean hammer for Habitat for Humanity. But I'm getting ahead of my story. I should start at the beginning. James Earl Carter was born October 1st, 1924, in Plains, Georgia, where, as it turned out, he would be the first U.S. president to be born in a hospital. His father, known as Mr. Earl, was a landowner, entrepreneur, warehouse owner, and peanut farmer. His mother, Miss Lillian, was a nurse and a midwife. The family lived in Plains until Jimmy was four, at which time they moved a few miles away to an even tinier town, Archery, to be closer to Mr. Earl's peanut farms. But before the family moved to Archery, a baby girl was born August 18, 1927, to their next-door neighbors, Edgar and Allie Smith. Miss Lillian was the midwife in attendance. The next day, she brought her three-year-old son, Jimmy, over to see the new baby, Eleanor Rosalind. In spite of this storybook beginning, the two didn't really know each other until much later. Jimmy was busy out in Archery, having the barefoot boy with cheeks of tan sort of childhood, lots of fishing and hunting and playing in the pastures and creeks. But his life wasn't all fun and play. His father believed in hard work for children from a young age. So by six, he was working in the fields. and by 9 he was maneuvering a plow hitched to a mule. Mr. Earle was an exacting man, strict and difficult to please. Jimmy learned to work carefully and hard in his attempt to earn a word of praise that almost never came. His mother, Miss Lillian, was gone often, busy with nursing and other endeavors, a liberated woman well ahead of her time. Jimmy was to say later that he was mostly raised by the family's African-American servant, Rachel Clark. Rosalind, however, did grow up in Plains, where her father ran an auto repair business and drove a school bus. Her father died when she was 13, an event she claimed ended her childhood, as her mother, with almost no income, struggled to raise 3 children alone. Rosalind found work in a beauty shop as she finished high school, graduating valedictorian of her class. Her best friend during this time was Jimmy's younger sister, Ruth, who it turned out had a picture in her bedroom of her older brother, by then a cadet at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. Rosalind was so smitten by Jimmy's big smile in a naval uniform that Ruth arranged a double date to introduce Jimmy to Rosalind. Jimmy found Rosalind to be so pretty and smart and sweet that he told his mother the next morning that he had met the girl he was going to marry. And he did, July 7, 1946, 2 weeks after his graduation from the Naval Academy. He was 21 and she was 18. The next 10 years were a time of growth for the Carters. They had 3 sons as they moved from place to place following Jimmy's naval assignments. Jimmy served on several ships as a naval engineer, went to submarine school, and for a time they lived in Honolulu, where Rosalind learned to hula dance and Jimmy to play the ukulele. One incident during this halcyon period was to change Jimmy's life profoundly. He was being interviewed by Admiral Hiram Rickover for a position within the Navy nuclear submarine program. Admiral Rickover was notoriously stern and unbending. At one point, he asked Carter what was his ranking in his class at the academy. Jimmy replied that he was 59th in a class of 820. Rickover then asked him if he had always done his best. Jimmy had to reply that he had not, to which Rickover responded, "Why not?" Jimmy couldn't answer. He didn't know, but in reflecting and in thinking he hadn't made the program, he decided that from then on he would always do his best, no matter how small or inconsequential, nor how big and daunting the task. It became his mantra for life. Much to his surprise, Jimmy was accepted into the program, perhaps because he had been truthful. So he spent the next few years learning and working with the Naval Nuclear Program, including with the Seawolf Nuclear Sub and other secret projects. He was intrigued with what he was doing and happy with his life. Then he received word that Mr. Earle was dying. When Jimmy went to be with him, he discovered that it was his father's wish, and his family's too, that after Earle's death, Jimmy quit the Navy and come home to Plains to take over the peanut and farming operations. This was an agonizing decision, yet in the end, he was a good Southern boy who put family and tradition ahead of his own desires. He and his family moved back to Georgia, with Rosalind almost literally kicking and screaming all the way. She had spent her youth yearning to get out of Plains, and here she was, going back again. Jimmy and Rosalind had always been people of faith. Their families were church-going believers who saw to it that their children were brought up in the faith. Jimmy had even conducted Bible studies at the Naval Academy and services on ships to which he'd been assigned. However, something happened a few years after they moved back home that deepened his faith and his commitment. He and his sister Ruth, who had become an evangelist, went for a walk one day to talk and pray. During this walk, he had a religious experience of some kind that gradually led to a spiritual awakening that he referred to later as being born again. This occurrence, combined with his new determination to always do his best, which it turns out was considerable, made Jimmy a formidable, determined witness for Christ. With Rosalind beside him, he still is, almost 60 years later. I think it's fair to say that rather early on, Jimmy got bored with the peanut business, I think as one would. In looking for something to do that would benefit other people and live his faith, he settled on politics as a way to change people's lives for the better. He started with the local school board, then moved on to run for state senator, an election he won after proving his opponent stuffed the ballot box. Not being one to sit still long, he soon decided to run for governor. His first attempt was unsuccessful. The second, in 1970, found him winning against heavy odds. He always worked very hard, demanding the same dedication from everyone around him. Rosalind went from being a shy, scared rabbit to a confident, skilled campaigner who could work the room or give a speech with the best of them. This 1970 governor campaign exemplified something about Jimmy Carter's life that he isn't proud of, and perhaps even yet hasn't completely come to terms. As most of us know, the 1950s and 60s were a time of intense civil rights unrest, and nowhere more so than in the American South. The Carters lived in Sumter County, where the sheriff, Fred Chappell, was pronounced the meanest man in the world by Martin Luther King Jr., who'd had dealings with both him and Bull Connor, and considered Chappell to be the worst of the two. Jimmy and Rosalind were not racist, although his father and to some extent his mother had been. All the events around them, instigating for integration and civil rights, put them in a bind. As much as they might believe in these causes, their active support and participation would have resulted in flaming crosses on their lawn, a burned-down warehouse, death threats, and ostracization by the community. Jimmy couldn't even have been elected dog catcher. They tried to work around the edges and be as noncommittal as they could get away with while they kept their heads down. When Jimmy ran for governor, he managed to give people the impression that he was a segregationist without actually saying so. After Jimmy became governor, and certainly by the time he was president, he and Rosalind became seriously involved in civil rights and justice issues and have actually done immeasurable good on both fronts. Even Miss Lillian went to India as a Peace Corps volunteer in her late 60s, partly, she said, because of white guilt. So, does the end justify the means? The Carters aren't sure to this day whether they did the right thing. Jimmy still worries that not to have chosen sides and spoken out was cowardly and a breach of faith, something he does not take lightly. So the next logical step in Jimmy Carter's thinking was the White House. Some people would find it audacious for a first-term, little-known ex-peanut farmer Georgia governor to aspire to the presidency, but Jimmy thought he would be good for the country, and so did his friends and Rosalind. True to form, once the decision was made, he threw himself into the campaign head first. His biggest strength as a campaigner was that he really listened to people and sympathized with them. His Christianity was not a smokescreen, but the way he lived his life. Much to the surprise of the rest of the world, he started winning primaries. And by January of 1977, he and Rosalind and their young daughter Amy were on their way to Washington. Of course, all United States presidents are in a unique position to change the world, and they do some for the better and some for the worse. Jimmy Carter was no different. First ladies, too, usually work tirelessly to further their own particular causes. In Rosalind's case, mental health reform. There is no doubt that Jimmy did a lot of good in his presidency. He was a fierce advocate for human rights. His persistent work behind the scenes did more than anything to bring about the end of the Cold War. He was a strong early proponent of environmental reforms with his Green New Deal program, pushing through many reform measures in an attempt to stem the destruction of our natural world. His crowning achievement, and the one he's best known for, is the Camp David Accord between Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Menachem Begin of Israel. It brought about a peace agreement that is honored to this day. Yet on Election Day, 1980, Jimmy Carter lost his presidency to Ronald Reagan. It was a stunning defeat for him. He had felt a calling from God to restore honesty, justice, and decency to Washington and had worked unstintingly to do so. But the 52 hostages taken by Iran were still in captivity on Election Day. He had brokered their release by the day of Reagan's inauguration, but that, of course, was too late to help his reelection. The economy was struggling, again, not his fault, but the electorate are not economists and tend to blame the party in power for their economic misery. He also had a tendency to be too blunt, too outspoken, too preachy for many people's tastes. Plus, he and Rosalind tried to set an example of frugality and practicality by turning down the White House thermostats and wearing sweaters. They virtuously avoided ostentatious gatherings and galas in the interest of saving taxpayer money. Unfortunately, it mostly had the effect of making them look dowdy and humorless compared to the Reagans with their designer clothes and star-studded parties. Losing was a bitter blow that left them gutted and reeling. Of course, anyone who loses a presidential election is devastated. Adlai Stevenson, after one of his losses to Dwight Eisenhower, famously said that he felt like the little boy who stubbed his toe. He was too old to cry, but it hurt too much not to. For the Carters, it was especially devastating because they had truly felt they were doing God's work. Now they were being forced to abandon it, unfinished. So they dragged back to Plains, unsure what to do with themselves for the rest of their lives. This sense of failure was compounded by the news that in their absence, Jimmy's brother Billy had run the peanut business into the ground, leaving them with $1 million in debt. After salvaging what they could, selling what they couldn't, and writing their memoirs, they still were unsure what to do with themselves. By this point in our history, all retired presidents established personal libraries as a repository for their presidential papers and memorabilia. So there was that project to contend with. But they wanted to do more, something meaningful to help people, to follow Christ's admonition, to feed my sheep. Jimmy thought often about his success at Camp David with Sadat and Begin. It came to him that he could continue to do that sort of thing by working through a sort of consortium that would be housed in his library, and the Carter Center was born. Now Jimmy and Rosalind had a purpose. They traveled extensively, visiting and studying charitable organizations in an attempt to establish their vision for the Carter Center. They raised money, drew up plans, hired staff, and recruited volunteers. What they came up with is something truly amazing and very much in keeping with their desire to serve God by doing His will on earth. Starting with the awareness that they couldn't begin to heal all the ills and right all the injustices on earth, they decided to narrow their focus to three main areas: conflict resolutions, global health, and promoting democracy and human rights. Just those three little things. What they've managed to accomplish, working primarily in these three areas, has been breathtaking. When it came to conflict resolutions, it felt for many years as if Jimmy Carter turned up anywhere war was a threat, sometimes at the request of whoever was president, and sometimes on his own initiative. As a result of his Christian belief that all life is sacred, he hated war passionately and found it his duty to do what he could to prevent it. Some examples of his work include an agreement between North and South Korea in 1993 that froze the North Korean nuclear program for several years, just as the Clinton administration was poised to bomb North Korea. Another well-known incident occurred in Haiti, also in 1993. The Haitian strongman dictator, General Raoul Cedres, was resisting American demands for him to step down. After making several belligerent gestures, he forced an American ship away from a Haitian port. Carter had already made 8 trips to Haiti to try to lessen tensions. President Clinton's next step was to have been an invasion of Haiti, when Carter and his negotiating team were able to persuade Cedres to step back and let the American forces into Port-au-Prince peacefully. Carter was often criticized because he would meet with some of the worst of the worst of the world's dictators and rights abusers. He and Rosalynn would don flak jackets and head right into the middle of just about anything. What their critics didn't understand was that as Christians, they believed that no matter how wicked someone was, somewhere deep inside that person was something redeemable, a spark of the divine, and it was their responsibility to try to reach it. Jimmy continued to work for peace and safety for all citizens of the war-torn world whenever he could get it. Excuse me, better take a drink. Whenever he could get a foothold to maneuver, whether he had an invitation or not. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. We're not just words, but words to live by. Another important service provided by the Carter Center was monitoring elections. In an effort to provide free and fair elections, teams from the Carter Center, often led by Carter himself, moved in and set up operations in third world countries all over the globe. The Carters believed in the importance of free elections and the democratic process. True to form, if they thought something was important, they backed up their beliefs with elbow grease. Nothing illustrates that sentiment better than the Carters' commitment to Habitat for Humanity. An aside, our own Ron and Jenny headed up the Ellis chapter of Habitat for several years. Many people believe that Jimmy and Rosalynn started Habitat because they are so often pictured in their work clothes, hammering and sawing away. But they did not. It grew out of a project started by Millard Fuller at Koinonia Farms down the road from Plains. The Carters are enthusiastic supporters who are not only on the board, working behind the scenes, but active and skilled participants in the actual building of Habitat houses. Until well into their 90s, they budgeted 1 week out of their year for working on a house, sometimes in the U.S. and sometimes in another country. Possibly the area that the Carter Center is best known for, however, is for its work in the field of global health. The Carters have been especially moved by the poverty, poor sanitary conditions, and the resulting diseases and health crises facing such an overwhelming number of our world's population. They have tried to narrow their focus to where they can do the most good with their resources. Early on, they became aware of guinea worm disease, an incurable, preventable disease that in 1985, a infected nearly 10 million people. It is spread by worm larvae entering the body through stagnant, dirty water. Once a person is afflicted, the consequences are horrifying. It takes about a year before the worm emerges through the skin, a painful burning process that leaves a pustule that continues to hurt and burn. More appear, eventually causing the affected person to be unable to walk or work. The answer is to eliminate the larvae from the water. The Carter Center teamed with the World Health Organization to not only treat the water, but provide free cloth filters from the same material as parachutes and waterproof and bulletproof vests. By 2014, the number of guinea worm cases reported around the world was 150. It has, in 2021, almost been completely eradicated, but not quite. It still pops up occasionally. But think of the suffering that has been eliminated. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. By 2002, nearly two-thirds of the Carter Center budget was devoted to global health projects. They were fighting other parasites, notably one that causes river blindness, an itchy rash that eventually leads to complete loss of sight. HIV, malaria, and trachoma were just some of the other diseases the Carters and their people took on. Rosalind still worked hard to champion mental health causes all over the world. For example, in 2010, the Carter Center Mental Health Program helped the Liberian government train its first mental health workers and instituted programs to reduce the stigma of mental health disease in that country. I could continue for quite a while describing all the good things accomplished in the world because two Christian people believed that their God wanted them to always do their best. Jimmy and Rosalind Carter made a commitment to do everything they could to help others. And wow, just wow. Jimmy once said that he was almost glad he lost the presidency because if he hadn't, he might not have had the impetus to start the Carter Center. He said that if he had to choose between a second term and the Carter Center, he thought he'd choose the center. A few years ago, a visitor was driving through Plains and saw an old man mowing the grass behind the Baptist church. He stopped and asked him whether this was the church where Jimmy Carter taught Sunday school. The old man said yes, it was. Of course, it was Jimmy. And Rosalind was inside the church building, running the vacuum cleaner. Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, two Christians who, because of their faith, changed the world. Thank you.
You've been listening to a message presented at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to local, national, and international missions, and they help to keep these podcasts free. If you'd like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our webpage at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button, or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our webpage and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.